major donor to the San Diego Asian Film Festival, which is an event near and dear to my heart. So I kept my business with them. So fast forward to a year later. I've realized this throw a dart on the map method of where to live doesn't take into account the income tax ramifications. California has some of the most onerous, repressive, and stifling income tax codes in the entire United States. So I decided to only spend summers there and make Florida my primary residence again. So I find a beautiful penthouse I like, and once again, the market is hot. In fact, in Miami, the market is blistering. And once again, the banks are clueless to the reality of the current situation. So this time, I'm trying to be clever. I go to LendingTree.com, where they say banks fight for your business. True enough, within minutes, I have 15 lenders sending me email pitches, including, of course, Wells Fargo. Now, a couple of things you should know before we go further. I probably have the highest credit score you can have for anyone not named Bill Gates or Oprah. I have zero debt, own everything outright, and I make a lot of money. I have at least 5 credit cards with over $50,000 or unlimited limits, all of which I pay in full every month. I'm the ideal target customer for any bank. So I start this process of applying for a mortgage with all the lenders from LendingTree. Well, it turns out the building I want to buy opened in 2009 during the bubble burst. There were a bunch of speculators in the building and a lot of foreclosures, so now the building is unwarrantable, which means neither Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae is willing to guarantee loans in that building. 13 of the 15 lenders immediately disqualify themselves. They're still living in the 2009 market, oblivious to the incredible opportunities that the 2014 Miami market is offering. Or, of course, the lucrative new customer they could land. It comes down to Citibank and my old friends at Wells Fargo. Of course, I call the guy who emailed me from Wells Fargo, and I explain my disdain for the last time I attempted to work with them, and told him, here's the deal, the building's unwarrantable, I'm not going to waste months of my life with all your bureaucratic crap, so if you can't get this done and get it turned around quickly, let's not waste my time or your time. He's actually a very conscientious, well-meaning guy, and he implored me to give him a chance to make things right with the bank. Once he finds out the building isn't warrantable, he knows he's in trouble. He tells me, this loan is no good to the bank because they can't sell it. Now, keep this in mind. I've at that point been a 16-year customer with Wells Fargo and moved millions of dollars through my account. I get that Wells Fargo or any bank needs to make a profit off my business to survive. I'm a free market guy. I have no problem with that. But can't they at least maintain the facade that they want to service my financial needs and keep me as a customer? Because what was my account rep really telling me? If we put it into Google Translate, it would come back as, "Sorry, Randy. The interest rate we would make on your loan isn't enough to satisfy us. If we can't flip your loan and gouge some extra money off you, we really could care less about keeping you as a customer." Still, my heroic rep, he's working hard to get the deal done and insists he can get a waiver for the building. Unfortunately, the situation turns into Groundhog Day again. Every day, endless requests for trivial and irrelevant documents. I mean, stuff like this. They would see a large deposit from XYZ Company in my bank account. And then they would ask me for a letter from XYZ Company verifying that they had really sent that deposit. Even though the money was in my account, in Wells Fargo, and that company had been sending me monthly direct deposits for more than 9 years. They wanted 3 years of tax returns, so I sent them right away. 3 weeks later, they said they needed to be certified. So my accountant literally drove the completed tax forms over to the IRS office and waited there until they could certify them. 4 weeks later, Wells Fargo then said they needed transcripts of the returns to make sure I hadn't exaggerated my income. Obviously, there must be an epidemic of people filing tax returns claiming extra income so they can pay more taxes, probably in a patriotic attempt to bring down the deficit, right? When I suggested that to my rep, he replied, well, it's just standard practice now to always get transcripts. So why didn't they just request that 8 weeks earlier? I asked him. Awkward silence. I wanted to close in 2 or 3 weeks. Wells Fargo couldn't get an answer, approval or denial, in 8 weeks when the closing was actually scheduled, and I would lose my earnest deposit money. At the last minute, I get a 1 week extension from the seller. Wells Fargo still couldn't give me an answer, only requests for more documentation. Once again, there was a box that couldn't be checked on the checklist and simply no process in place for an actual thinking human being to make a decision. Come deadline day, this poor guy who was handling my account was too embarrassed to even contact me anymore. He's the perfect example of a great employee choking in a dead organization. And this is what's happening in thousands of organizations today, which left me down to Citibank. Turns out they're no better than Wells Fargo and are probably worse. Just like with Wells Fargo, I immediately submitted everything they asked for. But like Wells Fargo, Citi doesn't really have a mortgage approval department. They have a mortgage obstruction department. So every few days, they ask for additional items not on the original list. Every few days, my assistant sends exactly what they ask for. I keep reminding them my closing deadline is fast approaching. It finally comes down to 4 days before closing, and they're stuck because they need not only a waiver because the building was unwarrantable, they want an additional waiver because of another lawsuit, and this time it's just a silly, inconsequential one between the building and the cable provider. So my rep from Citi says this shouldn't be a problem. But the 4 days expire, and they still don't have an answer. Remember, though, I've got a 1 week extension. So on closing day, I tell them I absolutely must have an answer. Either give me the loan or send a letter of denial that they're afraid to lend them the building for the two given reasons, and let me try and get my deposit back. 5 o'clock comes and goes. A supervisor emails me that she'll be watching the account all night and send an answer as soon as she hears. On a Friday night, in the banking industry. Seriously. Of course, I never hear a peep. Monday, I write again, because now I'm technically in default and risk of losing my $30,000 earnest money. They assure me they have escalated the file to the highest level executive who will get me an answer right away. The whole day passes without a word from them. The seller calls my title agent and demands that they release my $30,000 deposit to them and that I'm going to lose it. I send one final email to Citi the next morning. I explain the severity of the situation again and let them know that I can't process any more frustration or emotional distress from Citi not being able to give a simple answer on a loan request in a timely and professional manner. I remind them that I'm actually looking for more than a mortgage. That I'm really looking for is a bank and a banker who could handle all of my business needs. I'm an entrepreneur with many ventures, so I require a banker who thinks like an entrepreneur, not an entry-level employee at a fast food restaurant or a bureaucracy so bloated with mindless procedures that everybody's afraid or unable to make a decision. It shouldn't matter if I was requesting that mortgage to buy a crack house in Overtown or a brothel in Las Vegas. My financial statement, credit score, history, and credit worthiness are solid enough This should have been a 48-hour decision. So I make it clear in this email that one of two things has to happen that day. Number one, send me a written approval via email to me and my title agent giving rates and what time the funds will be in my account. Or number two, send me a letter of denial based on their fear of financing the building because it's unwarrantable and has the lawsuit, so I can make an attempt to see if I can get my deposit back. So I close with these exact words. Let me make this very clear. There are only two options available. Sending me another message that the process is continuing and a decision hasn't been reached is not acceptable. I need to have the funds available by tomorrow so I can make one last effort with the seller that they will accept the deal and not attempt to seize my earnest money deposit. Or I need your letter of denial so I can attempt to get my deposit back and hope that your bad faith actions in this matter hasn't cost me $30,000. So at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, my rep from Citi responds with a reply stating, I have to offer my apologies as we aren't in a position to meet the first option at this time. We are unable to proceed with any type of approval without requesting additional documentation from you. Here's the additional documentation that Citi was asking for. A letter stating why I own some property in Florida that I don't even own. A signed dated letter that the tenant in the property I was buying would be vacating the property. There was no tenant. A copy of the lease from that imaginary tenant who didn't exist. And a detailed letter of explanation signed and dated explaining why I moved to California and was now buying in Florida again. At that point, what can you do? I replied, send me a letter of denial and stop wasting everybody's time. Which leads us to the first lesson in all this. You can't do business with small-minded people. There is not a force on earth with enough power to overcome a low-level bureaucrat in a cubicle who wants to kill a deal. If you ever find yourself in this situation, the smartest move is to cut your losses and move on. I ate my 30 grand and went away. Now, I don't tell you all this just to rant out my frustration with bureaucratic companies that are so clueless they don't realize they're really operating customer prevention departments. Okay, maybe just a little. Both Wells Fargo and Citibank are textbook examples of the kind of organizational thinking and culture that dominates a lot of C-suites in the corporate world today. Yes, the banking industry is particularly infected, but you'll see this kind of backward, bloated, out-of-touch thinking in a lot of industries. It's the ultimate herd thinking. Any employees with an entrepreneurial mindset in these organizations are driven away, and the only people left are the mindless drones who can only tick boxes on checklists. You can bet my net worth is higher than 999 of the last 1,000 mortgages both banks approved. You can bet my credit score is higher than 999 of the last 1,000 mortgages both approved. You can bet my annual income is higher than 999 of the last 1,000 mortgages both banks approved. There was no debate to my credit worthiness, character, or ability to repay that loan. But both organizations have a culture of institutionalized stupidity. If every box on the form can't be ticked, there's no one with the ability and latitude to fix the situation and keep the customer. They're not too big to fail. They're simply too big to excel at anything any longer. One last note on banking that's worth looking at. The biggest trend in banking these days, of course, is the reemergence of small local banks. But of course, they won't have any better success than the dinosaurs if they don't think at a higher level either. During the fiasco that I was experiencing with Wells Fargo and Citi, my real estate broker suggested we offer a chance at my mortgage to a friend he had at a local bank in Orlando. My experience there wasn't much different with delays, red tape, arcane procedures, less than efficient bankers seemed to be harming more than helping. Now you say, well, that's not breaking news. There's another lazy worker drone working in the banking industry. I mention it only because of the man's job title. He was the bank's president. Do you think the banking industry is prepared for the challenges of offshore banks, cryptocurrencies, Apple Pay, digital wallets, and all the other developments in finance and payments? Of course they're not. We have to question if there really is a purpose for banks in the new economy. The banking industry is easy to pick on because large institutions like Wells Fargo and Citi operate in this alternate universe, which we call the past, where they think they're so big and indispensable that they can dictate terms and make their customers jump through hoops to meet this ever-growing need for bureaucracy that they have. But those days and those types of organizations won't last. The real issue you should be concerned with is how the culture in your organization stacks up in this regard. And here are the questions to ask about your organization. Do you have a process or system in place now that is overcompensating for a market situation that existed 1, 2, or even 5 years ago? Are your people empowered to make decisions to save a valued customer? Have you added so many layers of bureaucracy that you're now out of touch with your market? Is your buying process set up to make things easy for your prospects and customers? Or do you make them jump through hoops to make things easier for your bureaucracy? And finally, the last question, what is the one development that could disrupt your industry and make your organization irrelevant? Last thing before we go to the next thing, I have to tell you this note. 7 days after the final deadline, when I lose my $30,000, my Wells Fargo rep emails me excitedly to tell me he had an approval if I would just submit another 5 items. I didn't know whether to scream, eat a banana, or stick my head in the oven. The curious thing about curiosity. I was in a taxi heading to the Birmingham, Alabama airport on my way home after a softball tournament. As we rolled up, a sign proclaimed, "Welcome to the Birmingham International Airport." Nothing special, the same kind of sign you see at the entrance to practically every airport everywhere. But something unusual about that sign intrigued me. Think about it. I'll wait. I asked the taxi driver, what international airline flew into Birmingham, Alabama? He had no idea. So I asked the skycap. No idea. Check with the counter agent. She didn't know either, but now she was intrigued as well and asked the agent next to her. She didn't know. We asked the next one, called the supervisor. Not one of them knew. On the 8th agent, we finally got the answer. There was a Delta flight from Atlanta to Birmingham that was a code share with Aeromexico, thus making Birmingham an international airport. How many hundreds of thousands of travelers have gone past that sign and never wondered about it? I believe the curiosity that caused me to ask that question and continue pursuing it until answered is the same trait that has made me a successful entrepreneur. The power of curiosity to drive innovation, critical thinking, and creativity cannot be overstated. Curious, not furious. Back in 2007, I was asked to deliver a keynote for the National Speakers Association, also known as NSA Convention. The convention organizer was the previously mentioned Ian Percy, and he asked me to speak on the subject of prosperity consciousness. He specifically asked me to challenge the audience, something I love to do, and to question any limiting beliefs I thought that were holding them back. In those days, NSA was a very conservative organization committed to doing things the same way they had been doing them since the 1970s. There were a lot of talented people there, but most were motivational speakers with cyclical, unstable businesses. And unfortunately, a number of not-so-talented people, those are the ones still telling that Bannister 4-minute mile story, why grandma cuts the ends off the ham, turkey, roast beef, and the starfish story speeches. The majority of both groups followed the business model of, it's easier to find a new audience than create a new speech. So, preparing myself for the speech, I'm looking over the members' website. It appeared that the organization contained 573 people who were the number one sales trainer in the world. There were at least 300 claiming to be the preeminent motivational speaker in the galaxy, and at least a dozen who really could move mountains with a mustard seed. So I challenged the audience with a couple few relevant questions, such as, if you're such an amazing sales trainer, how come you can't sell more of your speeches? If you're such a dynamic motivator, how come you can't motivate speakers bureaus to call you? If you're such a successful business development consultant, why don't you just hire yourself? And finally, if you really can move mountains with a mustard seed, why can't you get Oprah to endorse your book? Now, I wasn't asking these questions to be snarky. Not that I'm above being snarky, mind you. But I did want to point out the incongruities between the skill sets they were selling to their clients and the actual results they were achieving in their own businesses. But the real place I wanted to take them was to questioning their core beliefs about self-worth and prosperity. I wanted them to examine what was really holding them back in their career. Did they simply have the wrong marketing copy, demo video, or website? Or were they subconsciously self-sabotaging their success due to worthiness issues? There were about 1,500 people in the room, and by this point, there was a lot of fidgeting and nervous laughter. But to NSA's credit, at least 1,480 of them were sincerely willing to do that critical thinking and explore the issue. In fact, it's more than 8 or 9 years later, I'm still getting letters from people who were in that audience telling me that speech was a seminal turning point for them. However, there were a couple dozen other people there who were absolutely furious with me. Maybe because of the mustard seed jibe, or perhaps because my Facebook profile lists me as a fundamentalist agnostic, but they equated me to everything from a heathen to the Antichrist. Several of them stormed out of the convention hall, slamming the door behind them. And because they make convention hall doors so they don't slam very loudly, one lady actually came back in so she could re-exit and slam it again. Entrepreneurs don't have the luxury of such closed minds. We don't even have the luxury of simply objective minds. Please take a breath and let me repeat that. We don't even have the luxury of simply objective minds. If you really want to unleash your mad genius, you have to be willing to question any and all core foundational beliefs you have about everything. Question everything. You start with being objective, then become subjective. Then you become unreasonable. And if that still doesn't take you where you need to be, you move on to outrageous. Question everything. Beliefs are a really funny thing. Most everyone has some unreasonable and outrageous beliefs, but they believe they're completely sane and sensible. As a result, most people are very averse to questioning their beliefs. But that's where the real breakthroughs live. Question everything. It's all about critical thinking to make sure your beliefs are based on correct premises. It's only by examining, questioning, and then analyzing your beliefs that you can determine if they really serve you. Question everything. If your beliefs serve you, you keep them. If you find a belief doesn't serve you, remove it like you would an ill-fitting coat and replace it with one that serves you better. And the next time someone challenges a core belief you hold, try being curious instead of furious. He says the sky is red. But I know it's really blue. They taught me that in the second grade. I can look out the window right now and see blue sky. So why does he believe the sky is red? Curiosity comes from inquisitiveness, and being inquisitive is a foundation for creative thinking. By their very nature, brilliant entrepreneurs question everything. Why is everybody doing it this way? Why can't it be done? I know it's impossible, but if it were possible, how could we do it? Danny Inney, a friend of mine, is the founder of Firepole Marketing. He's got a fast-growing online business. Here's what he told me when we had this discussion. From where I'm sitting, the most important foundational factor for entrepreneurial creativity is an attitude of why we should and how we will, as opposed to whether we should or why we can't. I'm not saying you should run with every harebrained idea, but you can't know which ideas are really harebrained and which have that touch of mad genius that makes them awesome, and at the same time, just far enough out there for most people to reject them as too complicated or too risky. The first step to being creative is to say, yes, let's do it. Here's how we can make it work. Entrepreneurial brainstorming should be conducted like an improv class, in which the cardinal rule is always that you run with the improvisations of your colleagues, never contradict, and never say no, because that just kills the energy of it all. Make it a rule in your organization that whenever a new idea is proposed, the first response has to be positive and supportive, cultivating that idea. This can be very difficult, but it's worth it. I don't always succeed, but I've tried very hard to eliminate the knee-jerk no from my vocabulary and replace it with tell me more. Question everything, including the idea you should question everything. Don't buy into the conventional beliefs. Every industry has its sacred cows and accepted practices. These are based on foundational beliefs, and often those beliefs are based on premises that are no longer valid, if they ever even were. Earlier I said that mobile apps won't just change marketing, they'll change everything. The reason these apps and other new business models can be so disruptive is because they're often created by people who aren't from the industries they're disrupting. There's a reason Amazon was started by Jeff Bezos and not anyone in the bookstore industry. And Uber was started by people who weren't in the taxi industry. Because they were not in those industries, these pioneers hadn't bought into all the limiting, conventional beliefs possessed by most decision makers in those spaces. I'm sure lots of people in the taxi industry thought about using GPS systems to route drivers to fares. But because they were stuck in the herd thinking of their industry, they probably threw out the idea as too expensive or not feasible. They were vested in their system of dispatchers and radios, and because they had a monopoly, they felt no urgency to test other models. But the free market blew them up. When the Kickstarter campaign for the Pebble Time smartwatch raised $8 million in about 12 hours, that was your clue that the rules had changed. Human nature seems to have a default setting about innovation. Anything in existence when you were born, no matter how stunning of a quantum advancement it was, just seems ordinary and natural to you. Anything new developed when you're in your teens and your 20s is breathtaking and revolutionary, and you're excited to be a part of it. And anything developed after you're 40 is irritating and evil because it prevents you from going back to the way things were. Bookstores thought people would never buy books online, and record companies thought they could ban music downloads. But you can never turn back the clock. I love a good bookstore as much as anyone, but I still order most of my books from Amazon. I actually still have the original Dark Side of the Moon and some other classic LP albums. But 99% of my music is on my iPhone. This is not a cautionary tale of the taxi industry, the bookstore business, or record companies. It's a wake-up call for every industry. Taxi companies won't beat back ride-sharing apps because they provide great value to consumers and achieved immediate acceptance. Other industries won't defeat disruption in their space because disruption is intrinsically pro-consumer. It works only if the marketplace accepts it, and the marketplace accepts it only if it's doing something better, faster, or cheaper, or all three. If you're in a business trying to restrict or outlaw an app or a business model that threatens you, you're already a dinosaur. You'd be better off working to develop a better app. Market destruction is tough when you're the collateral damage. But that's the way free enterprise works, and free enterprise is the only way to keep an economy vibrant. It's not about the destruction, but rather the creation that comes from it. Overthrow the government. Okay, we don't really have to overthrow the government. At least, not yet. But the internet, mobile apps, and other disruptive developments will continue to force us to change the way we think about the power, scope, and role of government. In 48 states, purchasing a Tesla automobile is restricted or even illegal. Why? Because Tesla doesn't use dealers. Dell Computer built their entire business on the direct-to-consumer model, and no one had any issue with that. Probably the most successful retail outlet of the last decade was Apple selling direct to customers in their superstore. Again, no issues. So why the pushback against Tesla? The laws in this space were created originally to protect franchise dealers of automakers like Ford, GM, and Chrysler. Today, Ford or Chevy couldn't open a store in LA even if they wanted to. Of course, Tesla has a new business model and had no existing dealers to protect. So what's the problem? Those existing dealers for the legacy, for the other automakers. They like the system just the way it is, and they don't want to give their manufacturers any ideas. They're trying to prevent disruption through legislation. As I'm writing this, the state of Utah is trying to shut down Zenefits, a new startup that offers a cloud-based dashboard to HR departments. The dashboard helps manage HR functions like hiring, benefits, and payroll. Zenefits offers the dashboard for free and makes money from insurance commissions if companies opt to sign over management of their insurance to the company. It appears that the other insurance agents aren't particularly fond of competing against free. So like other disrupted industries, they've lobbied their government representatives to ban Zenefits. Utah's insurance commissioner accused the company of violating the state's rebates and inducement law by giving away its software for free. A similar dynamic is taking place with websites like Airbnb, which offer homeowners the opportunity to rent out to short-term guests. In most locales, services like these are operating in the shadows as governments haven't decided how to deal with them. But of course, they're attracting some vocal critics because the model could disrupt real estate and hotels. Probably the most visible example of this clash between disruptive models and archaic law is Uber. In many cities, cab companies are lobbying local governments to protect their monopoly by banning ride-sharing apps. You've heard all the arguments, I'm sure. Drivers aren't vetted, vehicles aren't inspected, the government hasn't sanctioned them, taxi drivers have paid the requisite permits and medallion fees, passengers will be at risk, blah, blah, blah. That's the way we've thought about the taxi business and protecting consumers for decades. But is that thinking really still serving us today? If I call a taxi in Miami, I'll get a beat-up old car, and it's a crapshoot whether it will have a working air conditioner, accept credit cards, or show up within 20 minutes. If I call one in San Diego, the cab will be newer, it's probably a hybrid, and it'll arrive within 10 minutes, but 40% of the time when I offer my credit card, the driver will respond with something like, "You don't have any cash?" When I hail an Uber in either city, the driver will be waiting in front before I get down the elevator. The cars are always new and clean. The drivers are always friendly because they know the app gives the customer an opportunity to rate them after every hire. The charge and tip are automatically billed to my credit card, saving me time, making my bookkeeping and my tax receipts seamless. As I was writing this, Paris is one of those cities in the throes of a taxi Uber war. I mean, the taxi drivers there have been staging protests, parking their cabs in the street, attacking Uber drivers, creating horrendous gridlock. Like cab drivers in other markets, they want Uber banned to protect consumers. What's the reality? I go to Paris frequently, and I can testify it is notoriously under-taxied with filthy old cabs. If you want to get across the city in the evening in a timely manner, your only option is to take the metro with riders packed in a grubby car. The idea of calling a taxi company for a pickup is virtually non-existent there. And hailing a cab from the street often involves wait times of 20, 30, or 40 minutes. Once I almost missed my flight home because it took over an hour to hail a taxi in the Marais district. So naturally, last time I went there, I opted for Uber. The driver shows up within minutes in a meticulously clean, new Mercedes with a daily newspaper and a bottle of water for me. The dinner companions I was meeting charted my progress until I got there. The driver was dressed sharp, very friendly, and spoke three languages. I got to dinner in half the normal time for roughly the same price. I was so impressed, I booked him to take me to the airport the next morning. He showed up the next day with a bag of fresh, warm croissants for me. Game over. The taxi model is built on a system of selling permits or these medallions for huge fees, ensuring that there are more customers than cabs. But that whole monopoly model breaks down when you have free market competition. Whether we're talking taxis, car manufacturers, Zenefits, Airbnb, or dozens of other startups, the situation is the same. Industries are being revolutionized by innovators with better business models, and the incumbents in the space are trying to use government to hobble or eliminate the competition. This forces us to ask the question of whether this is really the highest good for consumers. The disruptive times we're entering now will require a dramatically higher level of thinking about governance. We have to kill the meme that governments create jobs and prosperity. They don't. At best, governments can facilitate prosperity. Most times, they simply squander it or they kill it. And regardless of what governments do or don't do, the free market recognizes and responds to opportunities earlier, moves faster to solve problems, and develops more audacious innovation. The next decade will produce countless millionaires who thought, "I can do what the government does, only better." If you don't believe me, ask UPS or FedEx. Be like water. Of course, that comes from Bruce Lee, the legendary martial artist, poet, and philosopher. While he's been quoted often, few people actually understand what Bruce Lee meant by those words and the story of how that expression came about. I want to focus on it here because the story holds a very important lesson for how we have to change the way we think. The real story begins when Lee was still training with Professor Yip Man, the head of the Wing Chun School of Kung Fu, the only formal martial arts training Lee ever received. During the training, Yip Man reportedly came up to Lee and said, "Long, relax and calm your mind. Forget about yourself and follow the opponent's movements. Let your mind, the basic reality, do the counter movement without any interfering deliberation. Above all, learn the art of detachment." Now, these were abstract concepts to the young Lee, and he experienced great frustration and consternation. He would tell himself to relax, but instinctively do something to contradict his will. Seeing his anxiety, Yip Man returned again and said, "Long, preserve yourself by following the natural bend of things and don't interfere. Remember to never assert yourself against nature. Never be in frontal opposition to any problem, but control it by swinging with it." After a time, the instructor told his young student to stop practicing for a week, go home, get away from the routine, and reflect. Lee spent a week practicing and meditating, but felt no closer to what he was seeking. In an attempt to clear his mind, he went out sailing by himself on a junk in the Hong Kong harbor. Here's what happened next in Lee's own words. This is from his essay called A Moment of Understanding. "On the sea, I thought of all my past training and got mad at myself and punched the water. Right then, at that moment, a thought suddenly struck me. Was not water the very essence of Kung Fu? Hadn't the water just now illustrated to me the principle of Kung Fu? I struck it, but it did not suffer hurt. Again, I struck it with all my might, yet it was not wounded. I then tried to grasp a handful of it, but this proved impossible. the water, the softest substance in the world, which could be contained in the smallest jar, only seemed weak. In reality, it could penetrate the hardest substance in the world. That was it. I wanted to be like the nature of water. Suddenly, a bird flew by and cast its reflection on the water. Right then, as I was absorbing myself with the lessons of the water, another mystic sense of hidden meaning revealed itself to me. Should not the thoughts and emotions I had when in front of an opponent pass like the reflection of the bird flying over the water? That was exactly what Professor Yip meant by being detached. Not being without emotion or feeling, but being one in whom feeling was not sticky or blocked. Therefore, in order to control myself, I must first accept myself by going with and not against my nature. So after his epiphany, Lee just lay there and let the boat drift freely, feeling united with Tao. He possessed a feeling in which opposition had become mutually cooperative instead of mutually exclusive, and he lost all feeling of conflict in his mind. That experience on the water was a breakthrough moment for him, and it became a defining concept later in life when Lee went on to found Jeet Kune Do. And that is where we can learn much about how we can best respond to challenges, setbacks, and the mindset necessary for mad genius. Because here's the thing. At some point in your quest for mad genius, you're going to get stuck in conventional thinking caused by your existing beliefs and programming. Or you'll finally break from that, but will encounter clients, co-workers, or bosses who are afraid of big ideas. They will be armed with feasibility studies, committees, or long-standing corporate culture of why bold, daring, and imaginative things simply cannot be done. It is times such as these you must be like water. Bend, adapt, reshape, and reform. Find new directions or different levels. You have to stop trying to assert yourself with frontal opposition against nature, but bend with it. Sometimes you don't have a choice in the events that happen to you, but you always have a choice in how you respond to those events. Tap into the power of the mastermind. Bob Nagin has been an entrepreneur for pretty much his whole life. He ran his own retail business for years, and nowadays he and his wife, Susan, have a very successful practice coaching other retailers on how to be successful. Bob's a big believer in the power of the mastermind. Here's what he told me when we talked about this. I've concluded that the foundation for my creativity comes from long, hard-earned experience. But the spark that brings out my genius is the energy and feedback I get from the people I'm serving when I'm speaking or coaching. Our marketing techniques for small independent retailers are the most innovative and effective anywhere, period. But someone else was always the spark that brought them to life. Something someone else said or asked was always the catalyst to every original strategy, tactic, or technique. Now, the Nagins are also participating in that other mastermind group of internet marketers that I was a member of. We relish the creative spark that comes from getting bright minds together to create a more powerful mastermind. The most famous proponent of the mastermind is probably Napoleon Hill. I'm a member of several informal mastermind groups with some bright friends, and then the mastermind council that I'm in with the Nagins. I swear by these groups, but I'm also a big believer in another piece of advice from Napoleon Hill, not as well known. The first mastermind alliance you must form is with yourself. We all have duality, both positive and negative. And the older most people get, the more they are drawn to the negative side. This is because the vast majority of subliminal programming and mind viruses circling the globe today are the negative and limiting variety. So if you're offered an opportunity, you have two choices. A, wow, I could really crush with this. B, that works for other people, but it would never work for me. When you're facing a serious threat from a competitor, A, okay, we're going to have to get better, but we can beat this. B, I wonder if we'll make it. When a business venture is failing, A, what lesson can I take from this to win the next time? B, I knew it would fail. You have to have money to make money. Every one of us has a default setting. It is the mental attitude that determines whether we automatically go positive or go negative. There is a side of you that wants to wallow in victimhood and validate every setback as preordained. You absolve yourself of responsibility. You convince yourself that while you gave it your best effort, it was just not meant to be. There's another side of you, one that has faith and knows that no is never the answer. This side simply does not recognize defeat as anything but a temporary setback, a growing experience, and an opportunity to learn and modify. It is this second side of you that creates greatness and does epic things. That is the side of you you must nurture. Get in touch with that side of you and make that your first mastermind alliance. Get wet. Actor David Lawrence the 17th, who is also a serial entrepreneur, fuels his creative genius the old-fashioned way, in the shower. Here's what he told me. For me, when it comes to creative thinking, and especially when I'm having difficulty wrapping my brain around something, there's nothing in the world like taking a shower. I've had insanely great insights, created new and profitable products, solved thorny pricing and branding issues, even created whole new businesses by stepping in the shower and letting the isolation, the constant thrumming of the water, the repetitious and the familiar moves of getting clean, wash the distractions of the world away and allow my mind to open up and the breakthroughs to happen. And apparently, others are in on this too. Google shower creative thinking and you get over 2 million relevant results. Nurturing your inner artist. In December 2013 article in Forbes magazine on fostering creativity, Alex Knapp wrote, "And if you want to foster those creative problem-solving skills, the solution isn't learning to code, it's learning to paint, or play an instrument, or write poetry, or sculpt. The field doesn't matter. The key thing is that if you want to foster your own innovative creativity, the best way to do it is to seriously pursue an artistic endeavor." Entrepreneurs have no need for the science versus art debate. We know entrepreneurial thinking requires both. Albert Einstein said that if he wasn't a physicist, he would have probably been a musician. There are a lot of similarities in the creative process, whether you're composing an opera, scientifically testing a hypothesis, or creating the tagline for your new product. Creative people aren't necessarily